Thank you. Thank you very, very much, everybody. Thank you, Ben, for an extraordinary introduction. I'll have to find some way to bottle that one. And I'm enormously appreciative of it, and I'm humbled by it. And it's good to have a good friend like Ben Barnes, I will tell you. Anyone in politics in Austin during the 1960s knew about Ben, who had barely started shaving before he was elected to the Texas House of Representatives. And then he went on, as Greg said, to become the Speaker and later the Lieutenant Governor. But now he continues his service at the LBJ Foundation. And Ben, wherever you are now, Ben, thank you so much for being a terrific friend to so many people in public service and for your continued contributions. Much appreciated. I want to thank... Greg for the welcome to the University of Texas, to UT. He mentioned in his introduction the time we were able to spend over at the Pickles Research Center. What an extraordinary place, what extraordinary people. And what really struck me this morning was that while Texas is obviously so well known as the oil-producing part of America and has built its reputation on that for years, it really is now the energy-producing center of America. And what you are doing with respect to research on solar and wind, alternative renewable, is exactly what President Obama and I and others hoped would happen in the context of our efforts on global climate change and the agreement we signed in Paris. The agreement, obviously, is not going to guarantee we meet a 2-degree centigrade increase in temperature, but what it is going to do is send a message to the marketplace, exciting the allocation of capital, exciting our next Thomas Edison or Bill Gates or Steve Jobs to find a way to have battery storage or some cheaper form of a solar cell. And that is the way we're going to solve this problem. And University of Texas is going to contribute to that significantly. So, Greg, thank you for what you're doing. I want to add my voice to that of so many people here who I know beforehand have always have been praising what Ken Burns has done in his contribution to the study of history and the art of documentary film. I listened in the corner there to the conversation that was taking place. It was absolutely fascinating, honest, which is important on this topic. And I thought immediately that what I need to do is not give some long quote, keynote address as it is billed, but just try to share a few quick observations with you and then have the time to be able to have Ken grill me and we can have a good conversation. And I think that might be a little bit more productive and rewarding for everybody. But his unbelievable accomplishments on Brooklyn Bridge, the conservation of our national parks, the epic narrative of the Civil War, his latest film on Jackie Robinson, the film on baseball. This guy really taps into the pulse of our nation and has a way of presenting it that is just absolutely sheer delight, subtle, brilliant, honest. And I am absolutely more than confident that the extraordinary time and the passion that has consumed this particular project means the final product is not only going to be a work of art, and you heard him, I mean, they're changing a word or two after it's locked, it's going to be the definitive examination of Vietnam with profound impact, not only on the way that America thinks about that war, but I think on America's engagement with the issue of war itself. And I think it will do so for the better. I know that this conference and tonight, this topic, these couple of days, call for a serious analysis of what happened and why. This is about history. But it's also about us, about our heart and soul and our gut, about how wrenching it was in the ways that Lynn and Ken just described to you. And this examination should help us to understand Santayana's famous warning to those who don't heed the lessons of the past. So I look forward, when I finish, to a good exchange. But to lay the groundwork for that conversation, let me make a few key points that I think are key in the context of this conference that might not otherwise surface as we are principally looking backwards. First, those who expressed concern about the way the war in Southeast Asia was conducted were, I think this film will show, clearly justified in those concerns. I am not going to dredge up all of the old arguments. That is well-trod ground by myself and by others, including, I thought, quite definitively by Neil Sheehan, whose book title sums it up. As I know, we're going to be reminded by Ken's documentary, there were mistakes in leadership, mistakes in communication, mistakes in strategy. There were huge mistakes in the basic assumptions about the war. So it is not a surprise that public support virtually disappeared at a critical point of time. And we can talk about that a little bit. My second point is that the confusion that some Americans showed in blaming the warriors for the war itself was tragically misplaced. Our veterans did not receive the welcome home. Our veterans did not receive either the welcome home, nor the benefits, nor the treatment that they not only deserved but needed. And the fundamental contract between soldier and government simply was not honored. As a result, the vets themselves had to go out and fight a whole new round of battles. I know that well as one of the four co-founders of the Vietnam Veterans of America. They had to fight to get an increase in the GI Bill, fight to deal with homelessness and trauma, fight to have the ultimate sacrifice of their buddies memorialized on America's National Mall, and I thank Jan Scruggs for his extraordinary leadership with respect to that. So when we talk about Vietnam, to me, here is lesson number one. Whether a war is popular or unpopular, or it's not even what we call a war but a conflict, we must always, always treat our returning vets with the dignity and the respect that they have earned by virtue of their service to our nation. My third and final point is that we were right to work hard, and in some cases we still are working, to move forward from the pain and the division of the war, to begin a process of healing, both within our country and between the United States and Vietnam. We were right to think about what had gone wrong and to enact laws that shed greater light on how our government goes about its business. We were right to take steps to help Amerasian children and to welcome the many thousands of Vietnamese refugees following the fall of Saigon. Our Supreme Court was right to uphold the publication of the Pentagon Papers so that more of the truth about the war would be revealed. And we were right to pursue a full accounting of our fellow citizens who were missing or unaccounted for even after our POWs returned to our shores. Now let me say a word, if I can, about this accounting. It's not a well-known story in America, but it should be. For those of us, John McCain and myself particularly, as we approach the issue of normalization with Vietnam, The accounting for POW MIA was absolutely a prerequisite and non-negotiable. But this process of accounting, frankly, tells you something not only about us as Americans and our keeping faith with those who fall in battle. It also tells you something quite remarkable about the extraordinary openness of the Vietnamese people who helped us search for the remains of our fallen troops, even as the vast majority of theirs, a million strong probably, would never be found. They allowed helicopters to land once again, unannounced, in hamlets that brought back bitter memories of the war itself. And I remember negotiating with them to permit us to do that, because we had to have the element of surprise in order to prove to people they weren't moving people from where they were being kept. But the Vietnamese did so because they wanted also to move beyond the war. They dug up their fields and led us into their homes, their history houses, their jails. On more than one occasion, they guided us across what were actually minefields. And even today, as I stand here, thanks to a process that was fully embraced by President George H.W. Bush, with whom I had the pleasure of visiting yesterday in Houston, one of the greatest people in America, and General Brent Scowcroft, together, we were able to engage in what has become, my friends, the single most significant, most comprehensive, most exhaustive accounting of the missing and dead in any war in the history of humankind. And I think the United States should be very proud of that. We have people over there still today, as we sit here, working to complete that task of accountability. And I have to tell you, having flown in a Russian helicopter, which was an experience of holding your breath for hours, across Vietnam and landing in these places, I remember walking down 20 feet deep into a pit that had been dug by archaeologists because it was the crash site of a C-130, and literally looking at the wall of mud in which there was the detritus of the C-130, looking for the remains in order to bring them home and repatriate them. That is the depths and extent to which we currently go. Now, to be clear, and I want to emphasize this here today, certainly for me, and I think for most veterans, whatever their feelings were about the war, about what happened in America around the war, the process of reconciliation and restoring diplomatic ties was not about forgetting. If we forget, we cease to learn. And the tragedy of what happened in Vietnam has to be a constant reminder of the capacity to make mistakes, the capacity to see things in the wrong lens, the capacity to miss the signals, and ultimately to miss the constant reminder of the horror and the suffering that war inflicts. But neither should we become the prisoners of history. And I want you just to think for a moment, this is what I thought was a little different from where we'd be otherwise, and I will go, I'm sure, in the conversation with Ken. I want you to consider how far we have come since normalization. 20 years ago, there were fewer than 60,000 Americans visitors annually to Vietnam. Today, there are nearly 500,000. 20 years ago, bilateral trade in goods with Vietnam was only $451 million. Today, it is more than $45 billion a year. 20 years ago, there were fewer than 800 Vietnamese students studying in the United States. Today, there are nearly 19,000. And I was very proud as a senator to join in creating with my friend Tom Vallely, who is here, who was mentioned by Ken and others, the Fulbright School that exists today in Ho Chi Minh City, the second largest Fulbright program in the world. It was the largest for a period of time. And later this year, we will be moving ahead with the founding of the Fulbright University Vietnam, which will offer a world-class education and deepen the ties between our peoples. And I can tell you that a huge percentage of the current governing government of Vietnam have attended the Fulbright program or come over here to go to Harvard or to go to some university and share an education. That is a small measure, those statistics, of a remarkable transformation. And I can, I'll tell you a story. I can remember during the war securing a short pass to get to then Saigon and coming up from the Delta where we were stationed and sitting on the top of the Rex Hotel in a momentary pause from all of the craziness. And I was looking out at the city at night, watching these flares popping all around the city, everywhere, and in the distance, hearing bursts of gunfire and the occasional roar of a C-130 flying by, and occasionally the burp of what we call Puff the Magic Dragon. It was surreal, an oasis of sorts, but still the very essence of a war zone. You go back there today, which I have done, same hotel, same rooftop, but completely different view. A completely different nation. The traffic circle outside the Rex is filled with motorbikes, teeming with passengers in every form of commerce, from chicken coops to air conditioners to computer monitors to smartphones. Nobody's thinking about the war. In fact, most people, the majority in Vietnam, are too young to even remember it. It's a different era, and that calls for a wholly different relationship. No one back in 1968, I can tell you, could have possibly imagined General Secretary Chom's visit to Washington last year or President Obama's planned visit to Vietnam next month, which I look forward to joining him in. No one could have imagined the broad bilateral agenda that we have developed, including education, climate change, science, health, high tech, the internet, and military-to-military cooperation. And no one could have imagined the United States and Vietnam joining with 10 other nations to achieve a priceless opportunity on trade. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement represents nearly 40% of the entire world's GDP. And it will create jobs, enhance the environment, improve working conditions, and strengthen commercial ties from Hanoi to Tokyo to Santiago to Washington. And to be sure, let me make it clear, the true measure of our partnership is not just whether our economies grow, but it is how they grow. And we are working very carefully on all of those issues with respect to freedom and human rights. And by the way, within the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Vietnam has accepted labor unions the right to strike. So some of you may think we made a catastrophic mistake, but in fact, their rights have been enhanced. I have to tell you all, when I never thought when I was patrolling the Mekong that nearly 50 years later, I would be involved in a plan to help save that river. But together with our partners in the Lower Mekong Initiative, we are working to improve Vietnam's resilience to the effects of climate change, which they are already feeling hugely in the entire Mekong Delta. And we are focusing our aid on clean energy and the development of sustainable infrastructure and ecosystem resource management. We're also working together in the academic arena, the Institute of International Education, Arizona State University, Harvard Medical School, and the University of Hawaii. All have partnerships with institutions in Vietnam, several involving participation by the private sector. And 2 decades ago, when the United States and Vietnam did normalize relations, we might have been able to foresee that our countries would eventually cooperate on economic matters. But something far less predictable is now the new normal. We are cooperating on security issues as well. Now there is and particularly, I might add, with respect to the South China Sea, but that's not all. On many other issues of security, we are engaged in discussions and in actual programs. Now, as I say all of this, where we want it to be? No. There's no question that our government and the government of Hanoi obviously continue to have differences. But the good news is that we talk about them frankly and regularly and often productively. And for anybody who tunes in to what the original goal was with respect to our efforts in Vietnam, which were to protect the country from becoming communist, let me make it clear to you today that while it is authoritarian and one-party system, it's anything but communist, because communism is an economic theory. And they are as market-oriented as any country I've ever seen. A raging capitalism. What, notwithstanding, within the constraints of a one-party system that still, like the authoritarian model of China and others, tries to contain its population and move forward. History will determine whether or not that ever works out in the long run. So it's clear today that the Vietnam that we are engaged with, none of us could have imagined in the context of the discussion that is taking place here in the context of the war. And it's clear that Vietnam is reaching forward towards the globalized world of modernity. And millions of people in Vietnam are already freely expressing themselves on Facebook. And many thousands of Vietnamese workers are already freely associating to defend their interests, even though sometimes risky. They're the ones asking their government to guarantee in law the freedoms that they are starting to exercise in practice. And we know that the more progress that occurs in those areas, the more likely it is that our bilateral relationship, which has already come an extraordinary distance, is going to be able to ultimately reach its full potential. In 1971, when I testified against the war in Vietnam for the Senate, I spoke of the determination of veterans to undertake one last mission, so that in 30 years, when our brothers went down the street without a leg or an arm and people asked why, we'd be able to say, Vietnam. And not mean a bitter, memory, but mean instead the place where America turned and where we helped it in the turning. So, it has been 45 years since that testimony, but it is clear that we have turned some very important corners. There are hard choices still to make for our relationship to reach its full potential, but now we can say definitively, because so many Vietnamese and Americans themselves refuse to let our past define our future, Vietnam, a former adversary, is now a partner with whom we have developed increasingly warm personal and national ties. That is our shared legacy, and is one that I hope we will continue to strengthen in the years to come. Thank you.